Our guest today is Tristram Wyatt. He is a senior research fellow in the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford and an emeritus fellow of Kellogg College, Oxford. His research focuses on the evolution of pheromones. These are chemical signals transmitted between animals of the same species, influencing social behavior. Tristram is also an award-winning author with his Cambridge University Press book on pheromones and animal behavior, winning the Best Postgraduate Textbook Award of the Royal Society of Biology in 2014. What actually is a smell? Why is this an important sense to have?
Smells are the main way that many animals discover the world outside them. So it's how they find food, mates, where to live, detecting predators and other dangers. So smell is crucial to the behavior of many animals.
And can we talk about, start by talking about, so how are smells detected and recognized by the brain? Could you give us like a brief overview of the principles underlying this process?
Well, the important thing to remember about smell is, unlike the other senses, there are real molecules involved that are transmitting, have to be carried from your cup of coffee into your nose. So the surprising thing is that our understanding of smell at the molecular level is really quite recent. So it was two scientists who published a paper in 1991, Linda Buck and her professor, Professor Axel, who were able to show that there were receptors in the mouse that detect molecules. And they were a very interesting family of proteins. They were G protein associated receptors. And these are usually, in other parts of the body, hormone detectors, for example, detecting insulin and other hormones. But here, they were exposed to the outside world, and smell molecules coming into the nose would latch onto the receptors, and these would start off a process of nervous stimulation, and this would go up the axon into the brain, a particular area of the brain called the olfactory lobe, and thereafter be processed. So what they were able to identify is a large family of these olfactory receptors, about 1,000 in the mouse and rat, and about 400 functioning ones in humans. And each of these receptors would have a range of particular molecules that would bind strongly to them. So it might be a particular class, a particular kind of aldehyde. It might be a particular kind of alcohol. And if the right molecules come into the nose, then these stimulate those particular olfactory receptors, and the brain is able then to know what molecules are out there. Now, what that means is that if you don't have a particular receptor, even if the molecule is out there in the world, you won't detect it. And there are some odd examples in humans. I said we have about 400 functioning receptors, but each of us has a slightly different set. And so it was discovered quite early that there are certain flowers, fuchsias, that some people can smell as fragrant, and others, because they lack a particular receptor for a molecule ionone, they don't detect it. And there are similar examples for other molecules where some individuals will be able to detect the molecule in the air and other people won't.
So the distribution of receptors that you have expressed determines your sense of smell.
Yes, and that has an important effect on how we sense food. Because as you probably know, your tongue, with its taste receptors, only tastes and detects broad classes of molecules, so bitter and sweet and so forth. And it really is in the nose that we detect what food is like. So it's the what we call the retronasal pathway. So as you chew, molecules go up at the back of your throat, up into the nose in that direction, forwards. And it's those smell receptors that give us our, what we colloquially in most languages call the sense of taste, but it's actually really smell. And you can show that by, if you pinch your nose, you'll no longer be able to smell the things you're eating. So one example is coriander leaf, or for Americans, cilantro. And the majority of human populations around the world detect that as delicious. So I'm one of those people. But there's a significant number, I think about 10% of people around the world, who instead sense that as soapy and rather disgusting. So enterprising restaurants, certainly in America, have started offering things like hummus and other dishes with and without cilantro. And that's all because although the receptor I don't think has been identified yet, you can show that genetically this must be due to the presence of or absence of a particular variant of the receptor that detects the molecules that are characteristic of coriander leaf or cilantro.
That's interesting, because I'm one of the 10%, and I didn't realize that people like the smell until very recently.
Yeah, so you should always ask for it. ask your waiter to hold back in the kitchen on the cilantro or coriander.
So how much variation is there in the sense of smell between individuals?
Quite a lot. It depends on the smell. So for some of the olfactory receptors, basically everybody has the same version. But for some of the receptors, there is much more variation. And why, we don't know. I think what we probably can say is that if there is a lot of variation in a particular olfactory receptor, it means it's not important for life. And that's interesting, because one of the molecules that has been claimed to be a human pheromone by some people, and it's something we'll come back to perhaps later, is not detected by everyone. And you might expect that if it was a chemical signal, a pheromone that was important, that there'd be strong selection for no variation. In other words, if you had the wrong version, then that wouldn't pass on through the generations. And that's an indication that these molecules probably aren't the ones that they have been claimed to be.
Yeah. Just to linger on smells for a bit longer. So you mentioned that with the coriander, some people are missing a receptor. But why does this change, like, the valence of the smell? Why does it smell better or worse?
It may be that they have a different version rather than lacking it altogether, although that's also possible. So if you don't detect a molecule, it may be because you have a mutant version of the receptor that has a different binding site and therefore doesn't interact with that particular molecule. Now, it could be that the mutation is in another receptor that is more associated with detecting soapy smells, and so it's that receptor that's being stimulated by molecules coming off the plant, the coriander leaf. We don't usually at this stage understand that much about the detail of how molecules are interacting with the olfactory receptors. it's proved quite hard to crystallize the olfactory receptors. I think it has been done recently, certainly a long time back, for I think some of the insect receptors. But basically, the interactions are hard to study. So what we can say is that humans differ in what they can detect, and it does seem to be down to which olfactory receptor versions they have. But exactly how that's happening, we don't know. There are still lots of mysteries about the way that smell is represented in the brain. So if you think about vision and hearing, both of which were well understood many decades before smell. So the Nobel Prizes for those senses were awarded many years before the 2004 award for the sense of smell to Linda Buck and Richard Axel. For smell and vision, you can, in the brain, see how those are represented. So there are many studies showing that the retina, in effect, is replicated in the visual bulb and or visual cortex. And similarly, for hearing, you can find the different parts for the auditory cortex that match particular frequencies. And these are in a matrix which can be related to the physical world. The problem with smell is that there are so many different dimensions that molecules can differ in, whether that's molecular weight, different structures, double bonds, the position of those. And so it really is a multi-dimensional, it really is a multi-dimensional space. And although some imaging studies have suggested that it may be represented in the higher parts of the brain, in the olfactory cortex, by adjacent areas relating to molecules that are related, and that this may be conserved between the different individuals of the same species, that doesn't really seem to work that well, because that might work in one set of chemical dimensions, but not in another. And so there are still lots of things to be understood about the sense of smell.
And this is this would be like a continuous representation, because if you had a molecule that supposedly endogenously binds to a receptor, and then you tweak it by modify chemically very slightly, it would still bind, but just with less affinity, and somehow the brain should be able to represent this continuous change in chemical structure.
Yeah.
Right. So we don't really have a good understanding of why some smells smell better than others.
No, there have been many claims that the valence, the niceness or nastiness of a smell, can be predicted from its structure. I'm not sure how robust those are. But it's a fascinating area, and there's been big computing power devoted to it. And it is just fascinating because it's so different from the other senses.
Yeah. So let's talk about pheromones. What are pheromones, and how are they different from smells?
Well, pheromones are really just a smell with a message. So they are detected mostly by smell, and they are smells that are used as chemical signals between individuals of the same species. So the molecules are released by the signaler, and they're detected by the animal receiving the signal. Sometimes it can be hard to know whether something really is a pheromone. So the first ones that were investigated were what's now recognized as the classic silk moth pheromone. The behavior of the male when he detects the female pheromone is very characteristic. He flaps his wings, And indeed, that behavior had been noted by the 17th century biologist Schwammerdam. But the breakthrough came when a chemist realized that although you couldn't see the molecules, and with the chemistry of the day, you could only detect them in very in quantities taken from a very large number of animals, which I'll explain. You could use the behavior of the male moth when he fluttered his wings, when he detected the female pheromone, to track it as you did classical chemistry of extracting the molecules from the female pheromone scent gland and then fractionating the molecules into alcohol and water and treating those solutions with different acids and bases and so forth as you purified them. And at every stage, you could present your fractionation to the male moths, and if the pheromone was there, the males would respond with wing fluttering, just as they would to the natural pheromone from the female. Now, Buddendant, this German chemist, was very lucky that he chose the silk moth. One, because each female produces a tiny quantity, and so he needed 500,000 female moths to gather enough, a few micrograms of material. And also, he was very lucky because the males respond to a pheromone, which is a single molecule. And if he looked at any other moth, where the female pheromone is actually a combination of different molecules that all have to be present for the male to respond, it might have taken him another decade or more. But what he was able to do was follow the molecule through his fractionation process and then identify the molecule that was producing the signal. He synthesized the molecule, went back to the male moths and asked, have I got it right? The male moths responded with the wing fluttering, showing that he had got the right molecule. And that was the first pheromone to be identified. So that was in 1959. Very quickly, pheromones were discovered in other moths. And that's when they discovered that it was actually often a combination of molecules, not a single molecule. Fish pheromones were identified in the 1990s. Mammalian pheromones were discovered again in the 1990s and through to the early 2000s, when perhaps the most convincing mammalian pheromone was identified. And they actually had a lot of difficulty publishing the paper, but it was finally published in Nature. And this was for the rabbit mammary pheromone. And this is a molecule produced by the mother in her milk. And this stimulates the rabbit pups to suckle and it allows them to find the nipple. And this is really important in the biology of the rabbit because the mother only comes back to the burrow to feed her young for 5 or so minutes a day. And there's a scramble by the rabbit pups to each find a nipple to quickly get the milk. So all the pheromones I've mentioned so far are detected by smell. So even though it's in the rabbit milk, the rabbit pups are detecting it by smell. As I mentioned, fish have pheromones, and pheromones work just as well underwater because the sense of smell works just as well underwater as in air. And indeed, of course, in our own noses, the olfactory receptors are covered by a wet layer of mucus. So it's the area of our brain that's exposed to the air, and it has to be protected. So those neurons are, those olfactory receptors on the olfactory neurons are protected by this wet layer of mucus.
When you said that the moth only responds to that one single molecule of pheromone, do you mean that the wing fluttering behavior is controlled by one molecule or that the moth only responds to one pheromone?
So you could phrase it almost that one The male moths don't detect many other smells, so they have an enormous number of olfactory sensory neurons that only have that receptor on them. So there are, I don't know, 17,000 or so in the antenna, each of them having millions of the olfactory receptor that is tuned just to that single molecule, which is the female sex pheromone. And that makes evolutionary sense, because the only thing the males need to smell in their particular biology is the sex pheromone of females of their own species. So that's how they're going to find a mate. And in terms of that one molecule controlling the behavior, the answer is, I suppose, yes, that the way the brain is wired is that only if that molecule is detected on the antennae, stimulates the right nerves, and goes up into the brain, and then is processed, and then sends stimuli, nerve impulses down the nerves to the motor systems that then flap the wings. Yes, that's how the system works. And one of the nice things about moths is that each of those stages has been studied in enormous detail. In fact, I started this section saying that sometimes it was not clear exactly what's going on and whether something really is a pheromone. Now, the thing with the moths and many other insect systems is, on the one hand, we know an enormous amount every stage about the detection system. So we know the olfactory receptors now, we know the olfactory sensory neurons and the wiring and how those processes lead to the wing flapping that would, in most moths, lead to flight. In moths, we also know all about production. So we know about the genetics of the enzymes that are used to produce the molecules, which are the pheromones. We know a lot about the pheromone glands. We know, for example, that they are only biochemically active at the right times to produce the pheromone, at the right time of day to release it. And we know in related species of moths how the pheromone producing enzymes have evolved and how they've mutated in the different related species as they speciated. So we know a lot about the production of signals, and we know a lot about the receiving of those same signals, in this case by the males. Now, the contrast is between pheromone signals and smells that are what we call cues. So cues are smells that give information, but are not an evolved signal on the part of the sender. And the example I usually use is the smells that all mammals give off, including humans, of course, that are detected by mosquitoes. So female mosquitoes are exquisitely sensitive to the molecules that mammals give off. So to the carbon dioxide we give off in our breath, but also the smells from our feet, our armpits, our body, all the smelly things that mammals give off. But we just give those off by living. We have not evolved to release those smells to attract mosquitoes. In fact, we'd rather they didn't find us and bite us. What we have in the situation with mosquitoes is a highly evolved detection system in the receiver, but it's not an evolved system in the releaser. So these are not signals by the definition of signals, which have to have evolved both by the signaler and the receiver. So in the case of the moths, it's very clear to my mind that these are signals. We know all about the way that these signals have evolved in the female, and we know all about the way that these are detected and responded to by the males. Where it gets harder is where we have, in particular in mammals, we have molecules which do appear to have evolved to be released, but sometimes we may not be able to identify the pheromone gland. We don't usually know the biochemical pathways for the production of those molecules. And often we don't know the detail in terms of the brain circuits beyond detection in the receiver. And that goes whether it's a female pheromone detected by males or a male pheromone detected by females. And so then it comes down to making sure that it does fit other criteria, such as it really does look as though it has evolved for that function, that it affects behavior in appropriate ways and so forth. But that does mean that we're sometimes less sure about pheromones in mammals than we are in insects.
This is a key distinction between pheromones and smells, and that you need this sort of evolutionarily intentional dance between the signaler and the receiver.
Yep. But it is nonetheless a smell, in as much as it's detected by the olfactory system, which goes to a different part of the brain from the sense of taste.
Right.
Now, it's slightly complicated in many mammals by there being two olfactory systems. So there's an accessory olfactory system and a main olfactory system, and they have different receptors. They go to different parts of the brain, but they are integrated higher up in the brain as information. So there was a view in the early 2000s by some molecular biologists working on mice that argued that pheromones were only detected by the vomera nasal organ, which is the part of the accessory olfactory system, as opposed to the main olfactory epithelium, which is part of the main olfactory system. But neuroanatomists had known for decades before that some pheromones are detected by the main olfactory epithelium and go to the main olfactory system. And they also knew that the two olfactory systems do integrate higher up in the brain. And so this was a false distinction. I think partly because they were not neuroanatomists, they were molecular biologists. And they were making a story which kind of made sense, but actually didn't make biological sense so far as what we knew about pheromones. So, for example, pig pheromones seem to be detected by the main olfactory system, not the vomera nasal system. The rabbit mammary pheromone that I mentioned is detected by the main olfactory system, not the VNO. And lots of animals that don't have a functioning VNO nonetheless respond to pheromones. So that was a false distinction. And I think it actually held us back for a few years. And what was interesting was it was some of those same molecular biologists, as they did more tracing of the neural circuits, they did finally acknowledge that, yes, all the systems were integrated higher in the brain. And that included Linda Buck and some of the other molecular biologists who had argued initially that pheromones were detected mainly by the, or if not entirely, and only by the vomera nasal system.
So what was the evidence that it was, that they found out it was separate? So did they show that these molecules were only detected by the vomera nasal and not the main olfactory bulb?
They often didn't test the molecules on both systems at the same time. I think your question is a very good one. I'm not sure what sent them down that track. It is true that many mouse pheromones are detected by the vomera nasal system, but they missed that others are detected by the main olfactory system. And I think it just became a dogma. And scientists are human, and it became something understood by those schools of researchers. even though other people were arguing, actually, it's much more interesting because pheromones are detected by both olfactory systems.
Right. So before we talk more about like mammalian and human pheromones, I just wanted to ask about the type of behavior that is controlled by pheromones. Is it always social behavior?
In a sense that it's interactions between members of the same species, then yes, even if it's just two animals. So in that sense, it's social. But in terms of complexity, it may be in social mammals, and mice live in large groups where it's very highly developed. But in the social insects, we see perhaps the greatest development of pheromones for signaling. And pheromones are used for all sorts of things. Although the first pheromone to be identified was a sex pheromone, with the wing fluttering of the male silk moth in response to the female sex pheromone, very quickly it was realized that pheromones are used for all sorts of functions. So in fact, it was, I think, the following year, if not later that same year, that E.O. Wilson, an ant biologist at Harvard, showed a trail pheromone in ants. And again, you could extract the pheromone and then paint it onto the paper, and the ants would follow it. So you have in social insects trail pheromones in ants. You have alarm pheromones in all sorts of social insects. So when you're stung by a honeybee, the sting still in your skin is pumping out alarm pheromone. And so other bees will come and sting you near that spot. You find pheromones also affecting the development of animals. So not everybody would agree, but in the royal jelly, which is fed by the worker bees to the bee larvae, is what turns genetically identical bee larvae into a queen if they receive the royal jelly in quantity, and a worker if they don't. And what's happening is molecules in the royal jelly are interacting with receptors inside the larva and switching on or off hormones, which mean that the larva develops into an animal that is very different from a worker. It will live many times longer and will be sexually active and will be fertile in a way that the workers are not. So all sorts of interactions are mediated by these pheromones. And what's fascinating is the parallel development of pheromones in different branches of the social insects. So there's parallel development of alarm pheromones in the different branches of the Hymenoptera, in the wasps, bees, and ants. There may even be some parallel development of queen pheromones. So the queens release molecules which tell the workers the queen is present, and so they need not reproduce. It's a mutually beneficial signal in that sense. But if you go to the unrelated termites, which evolved in a completely independent line from cockroaches, they also have many of the same pheromones in functional terms. So they have sex pheromones, they have trail pheromones, alarm pheromones, and they have pheromones which appear to affect the reproduction and development of different castes. Although in their case, they have fertile males and fertile females that live together as king and queen. So in parallel, systems of pheromone communication and control have developed in these termites as in the Hymenoptera. And that also tells us something very interesting about the evolution of pheromones, to my mind, which is there's nothing inherent about a particular molecule that makes it a pheromone. The way that pheromones evolve is because they reliably give information, and thus gradually over generations and over evolutionary time into a signal function. So, for example, This has been looked at in fish, and it turns out that fish pheromones in things like goldfish are very closely related to hormones that are found in the blood of female goldfish as they mature their eggs. Now, in water, molecules leak into the gills and also in the urine. And so what is supposed is that back in evolutionary time, female goldfish were just releasing these molecules, and males initially were simply eavesdropping, and males that were by chance, by mutation, more sensitive to these molecules would get to the female first and would leave more offspring. And gradually, males became more and more sensitive to these molecules. Their receptors became more specific. They produced more of them. And on the female side, because she needs a male to release sperm over her eggs as she releases them, she would start to produce more of these molecules. So she would evolve to upregulate the production of these, and then gradually might change the signal if other goldfish species were producing the same one. So what we have is something that started as eavesdropping by the receiver, gradually evolving into an evolved signal by the emitter, in this case, the female. And so as you go across the animal kingdom, you can often relate the molecules that end up evolving into pheromones back to some function in another context that gave nonetheless reliable information about physiology or state or something like that.
It's like coevolution. That's so cool.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's also super cool in the context of like in ants or bees and termites, like you have all these complex pheromones that then regulates and controls like the overall a functional like colony of these animals that can work together.
Indeed.
Yeah, and the way that evolved is super fascinating. So you mentioned some human pheromones previously. So let me ask, do humans have pheromones?
Because we're mammals, I'm sure we do. The frustrating thing is, despite a very big literature about putative human pheromones, none have been properly identified. And the problem, of course, is that humans are hard to study. Human sexual behavior is particularly hard to study because it's something we mostly do in private. And despite pioneering research by people like Masters and Johnson in America in the 1960s, we really don't know that much about what people do in private. And the problem, so far as pheromones is concerned, is that people have jumped to conclusions, and I think perhaps it's fair to say, made claims that were not justified. So there are a couple of waves of human pheromones. The first was the suggestion that because tiny quantities of molecules that seem to be pheromones in pigs are found in human armpits, then it should be a human pheromone. It's a pheromone in pigs, so it should be a pheromone in humans. Well, one thing is that although the same molecules can be used by different species as pheromones, the fact that a molecule is used by one species as a pheromone doesn't tell you anything about its use in another species, unless it really is. And lots of arguments were made that there was more of these molecules. These were steroids, androstenone and androstenol, found in pig male saliva. There was a suggestion that there was more of this produced by male armpits than female. Well, actually, that turns out to be based on a very small sample. And in fact, many women produce just as much of this as men. as I mentioned, lots of women can't detect this. It's one of those specific anosmias. And if it was really important, then you'd expect that this would be evolutionarily conserved. So that's another reason why these two molecules from pigs are probably not pheromones. There was a brief moment when a molecule or molecules called copulins, fatty acids, that seemed to be pheromones in rhesus monkeys might be human pheromones. But the problem with the rhesus monkey research was other researchers found it hard to replicate. So that didn't go very far. And then in 1991, two American scientists patented some molecules that they claimed were human pheromones. And the two molecules were androstadienone and estratetraenol. And again, these were steroids. But the problem is that a patent, surprisingly, doesn't require that much evidence. It's more a claim of originality, of being first, and some evidence of efficacy, but not to the level that would be required for a scientific demonstration that would be robust. So you may remember that Butendant, the chemist who identified the silk moth pheromone, went through many stages. He isolated the molecules, he synthesized them, and then robustly showed that the synthesized molecules had the same effect with the receiver, in this case, the male, with the wing fluttering. Now, there is no evidence that these two American scientists did any of that with these molecules they claim to be human pheromones in the patent. And they don't describe even where they collected the molecules. So there's a suggestion implied in some other papers that it might have been scraped from the skin under plaster casts from people who've broken their arm. It was just bizarre. So basically, there was no good evidence that these two molecules really were human pheromones. That was 1991. Nothing happens until 2000 or so, when a famous scientist uses these two molecules for no other reason than the claim, and report that they have shown effects on the psychology of men and women who sniffed these molecules. And because it's a famous researcher who's done interesting work previously, these molecules get picked up. And so over the subsequent 20 years or so, we have 60 papers by serious researchers, all with very few exceptions, claiming to have found effects from these two molecules. And I found this very hard to reconcile, because these were good researchers. They all claimed to find positive effects. So what was going on? And it was at about this point, in 2017, 2018, that I started reading more of the psychological literature. And the thing about studying human pheromones is these are basically human psychological research. You have questionnaires, you ask people how they feel, and there might be some physiology involved, but that can also happen in psychology. And as I read more about the things happening in psychological research, the more I read about the reproducibility crisis. And this first started in 2010, 2015, with researchers trying to reproduce classic experiments that were in all the textbooks. So one of these was, if you get young students in their 20s to read words that are associated with old age, when they leave the experimental room and walk down a corridor, they walk more slowly. And if you have them read words associated with being young, they positively skip along the corridor. So the time to walk along the corridor was being measured by somebody who didn't know which words had been read in the other room, and they were just timing how long it took. So you'd think that's robust, it's double blind. But when people tried to reproduce the experiment, they discovered that double blinding the experiment was not enough. So long as the professor who analyzed the results believed what the result should be, they always found the phenomenon. But if they didn't know what result they were meant to find, they didn't find it. So basically, it turned out to hang a lot on how data was analyzed, which data was included in the final analysis, which questions were asked. And as you go across psychology, as Ed Yong, the science journalist, has put it, the only thing you can say is that as you go across psychology, 50% of the experiments won't reproduce. You won't be able to replicate them. And this is disastrous. So how does this relate to the story about pheromones? Well, what it means is that you can have psychological experiments that everybody believes in, but that turn out, if robustly replicated, turn out not to replicate. And one other example is a very popular TED talk about power posing. So a charismatic professor gives this TED talk. It's the second most popular, I think, on the TED website. And basically the idea is very attractive. If you stand or even are put in the posture by an experimenter in a confident stance, it will make you more confident. It will affect your psychology. It will even affect your physiology. Your stress hormones will be reduced. And it will affect the psychology such that you will take more risks after having taken this pose for just a few minutes.
And they taught this in high school.
Yeah. So it turns out the placebo effect may be strong, but the actual evidence for it is incredibly weak. So it started falling down 5 years after the first publication. So the first publication was 2010. And in 2015, other researchers couldn't reproduce the effect, either of the hormonal effect or the greater risk taking. And the original researchers fought back. But the answer turned out to be by doing the experiments differently. And that's what I want to talk about now, which is psychologists have been very impressive at thinking up solutions to the crisis. So basically, over a very few years, less than a decade, it turned out that you simply didn't know what to believe. And if half of psychology simply isn't true in the sense that it's not describing a real phenomenon, then what is the point of psychology? And the first idea came from drug trials. So to try to keep pharmaceutical companies honest, there is pre-registration of drug trials. So there's a central body where you send information about the trial you are planning, and then the body is meant to check that you actually done the trials and you've published the results. So the first idea is pre-registration, because the problem in psychology in particular is that if you look at the data, even if it didn't show your original hypothesis was true, or it falsified your null hypothesis, there is always something interesting to find. So you can always, looking back at the data, find something interesting, even if it wasn't what you were looking for. Now, the problem is, of course, that the statistics are based on the idea that you are not looking backwards, that you're only looking forwards. And so people have likened this, when you're doing it the wrong way, to drawing your bullseye and then putting your arrow in the bullseye after the event, or rather, or put another way, the arrow lands and then you draw the bullseye around the arrow where it just landed, is perhaps the better way of putting it. So how to stop that? Well, pre-registration. So you put in an envelope, if you're going to draw on paper, the analysis that you are going to do, the question you are going to ask, and then you stick to that. Now, of course, nowadays, you can stick your hypothesis and how you're going to analyze it on the web, and you can put that in a private place initially, and then you can make it available to everybody to say, look, this is the date stamped declaration of how I was going to analyze the experiments, and look, this is what I did. So that's the idea of pre-registration. It's been taken a stage further with something that's called registered reports. And more than 200 journals around the world, mostly in biology, but in other fields too, have adopted this format. So for this, pre-registration is taken a stage further. You actually submit this to a journal that is offering registered reports. And at this stage, it's sent out for peer review. So this is before you've done the experiments. And what's interesting is, of course, this is the time at which peer review can actually improve the experiments rather than saying, oh, you should have done it that way, because you haven't even started yet. And when, after a bit of back and forth, you have your experiments accepted in principle, the journal says, if you do the experiments in the way that you said you will, we guarantee to accept your paper, whether or not you get a positive result. And one of the pressures on scientists, particularly in biology, is that everything has to be exciting and a positive result. And if you look at papers in different fields of biology, including psychology, about 95% of papers are positive. If you look at something in chemistry or astrophysics, then it might be as low as 60%. So experimenters often do an experiment to find that actually their supposition was wrong. And they report that because that's important information if the experiment has been done well, because that tells us what is not in the world. And what's been found in psychology is that with registered reports, many more negative results get published because the journal guarantees to publish them. Editors normally in conventional journals say, you didn't find something exciting, I'm not going to publish it. Whereas with registered reports, we get it down to 60, 70% of studies are showing a positive result, but some 40% are saying we thought this would happen, but it didn't. That's a valuable building block in science because it saves other researchers doing that experiment or looking at how you did it and thinking, okay, what do we need to change to test a related hypothesis properly? So to come back to the power posing, what I find particularly impressive is the original junior researcher, so the postdoc in the original study, the first author, has actually on her website said, by the standards of today, we cherry-picked the data, and I no longer stand by those results. And she helped other researchers repeat her original experiments and also some variations on those as registered reports, so using that new process, and with 7 sets of experiments, including a full replication, they report actually there is no effect. So power posing is a very attractive idea. It could give you, by a placebo effect, the confidence for your interview or an exam, but it doesn't seem to be having the effect in the way that was originally proposed, which is sad because it's a nice story, but we understand a bit more what is really happening in psychology.
So I just wanted to ask you about like stories and signs. So we talked about the human pheromone story, the vomeronasal organ story, and then like power posing and stories in psychology. And it seems like stories are a very sticky thing that people like to hold on to, and like even in the face of counter evidence. But at the same time, and it might hold us back from making real progress. But at the same time, these good stories or good frameworks of understanding experimental evidence is also very important for science to progress. So what do you think is the best balance in telling stories about experimental evidence that you gain in order to make sense of it in a healthy way for science to progress?
I think one of the biggest impediments is the requirements of what is sometimes called disparagingly the glamour journals. So over the last 30 or so years, science has changed in ways that many of us recognize. And part of the problem of stories is that in order to get published in what we mistakenly call the top journals, whether this is Nature, Science, Cell, Current Biology, and the like, is they demand a very neat story. So there is such competition to publish in those journals that work has to appear to be completely sewn up. You need to have found all the molecules that are involved. You need to have done an extraordinary range of controls that appear to eliminate alternative stories. And this means that there is enormous pressure on people to come up with good stories, and they find them. But there is no evidence that being published in one of these top journals means that it's true. And in fact, one of the most interesting studies was looking at social science in Science and Nature, published over 10 years. And again, only about half the experiments could be replicated, and these were in the top journals. What was interesting in that case was that other researchers just asked to read the paper and rate them as likely or less likely to replicate were able to do that. And they were able to put them in a line of most likely to replicate and least likely. And when other researchers tried to replicate their studies, it actually matched almost as a straight line the predicted values. So what's weird in that situation is it could have been detected early on that those studies were too good to be true. But because they had a good story that seemed to be consistent with the evidence provided, people wanted to believe, both the original researchers and also the editors and the peer reviewers. So I think the first thing is to change the requirement for the perfect story, because in most areas of science, things are much more complicated. And particularly at a given moment in the research in a given field or a given system, there are things that cannot be explained. But the glamour journals require something that's very neat, and it may not be. So what we may find is that experiments that didn't work are not included in the final version. We may not know all the details of the experiments. It's actually very hard to replicate many experiments because we don't have the full data and the full methods to make those in another lab. So reducing the requirement for a perfect story is going to be important. Being able to publish negative results is incredibly important, and we're not going to progress until that's the case. And there are horror stories of whole fields that are based on an early experiment that actually turns out to be erroneous. Now, I've given the example of the human pheromone work, which was really based on very little evidence, and then it fanned out into this large number of studies. There are examples in cancer research where the initial study was wrong. But what people never have time to do, and this is also important, people never have time to replicate the original experiment. So there is an idea that these founding experiments were right. And so what you'll find instead is some poor research student in another lab thinking they are getting something wrong because they can't replicate the paper in Nature, not knowing that nobody can replicate it. But instead, people have moved on and are taking that as gospel, which in a way, it is almost a religious acceptance and belief that that original experiment must be right, and then building experiments out. And something that's interesting is the different cultures between different fields. And there's a great book called The Seven Deadly Sins. It's by a psychologist called Chris Chambers. And he was one of the people behind registered reports that they, in the journal he'd just joined, should change the system so the experiments were submitted before they'd been done for peer review and then would be guaranteed publication if they did them rigorously and according to the plan. In his book, The Seven Deadly Sins, published by Princeton University Press, 2017, he contrasts physics with biology, and in particular psychology. And in physics, if something looks too good to be true, well, one, before it's published, the originating lab is likely to have tried to replicate it many times. But perhaps as important, other labs don't accept it until they too have replicated it. And the examples he gives are cold fusion and some of the additional particles discovered at CERN. And in the case of cold fusion, again, actually at the same university as the human pheromone professors, the University of Utah, that collapsed. Cold fusion collapsed very quickly because other labs couldn't replicate it. And in fact, I think it was at CERN itself, they realized it was, I think, a faulty wire that had given them this new particle. So in physics, there are true replications demanded as part of the culture. In psychology, it's different. And it's very rare for the original experiment to be replicated. In other words, to actually try to replicate the original experiment in all its detail. What happens instead is an almost replication. So you might try this idea, say, priming, listening to old age associated words versus young age associated words. And instead, look at priming not in walking speed, but in self-regard, or the time taken to answer a questionnaire, or ability to remember something. So it's a parallel replication, but it's not a replication of the original study. In other words, you're taking the idea that reading old words genuinely has an effect, the priming effect is real, and so let's try it in something else. And that's partly because you can't get a complete replication of the original experiment published. Nobody will publish it. So in order to get published, you have to do something different. And you also have to find something exciting. So that's why you get these fanning out of experiments based on an original study and the original study itself in biology isn't replicated, whereas in physics, Chris Chambers argues it would.
Yeah, I guess the publishing bias is really has a big effect on the culture of the field.
Mm-hmm.
One final question, what advice do you have for young scientists?
Choose something that you enjoy and don't stay in a lab if you're not actually enjoying the process of the science. So what I mean by that is life is suddenly not going to get better when you have your PhD or when you finish this next postdoc or whichever stage you're at, in ways that will make the pain now worthwhile. So enjoy the process. And if you're joining a lab, make sure that you're talking a lot with people that have previously worked in that lab informally without the principal investigator there. So what you want is to get a real feeling for what your interaction with fellow scientists is going to be. So for example, at its extreme, there are apocryphal stories that I've heard from more than one person about a particular lab that suggest that the professor was giving the same question to different students, and they were actually competing against each other. And that's not a recipe for a happy place. Similarly, you want to know that your researcher has integrity, and that they are going to be doing things in the right way. So you want to establish all of that. So I think the most important thing, though, is that you enjoy the science and you enjoy what you're doing. And it shouldn't be a lab that is demanding too much and is taking all your social life away. And again, some chemistry labs are notorious for this, where it's a production line and very long hours are required. And the best places are ones where you actually have fun. Now, it'll be boring lots of the time, and that's the other thing you need to expect. To get the data, it's not always going to be fun, but your social environment should be accepting and welcoming, and you should be looking forward to going into the lab, even if it's going to be boring and dull, and the music will get you through.
Christian, this was a very interesting discussion. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure and great questions.